would like to thank you, Bruno, for joining us for this episode. We're here to discuss your book, Citizen Marks. And I must say, at the beginning, I'm a big fan of the book. I love the book. It's surprisingly, for a book on Marx, it's surprisingly easy to understand and to follow the argument. And I think I should just, you know, give you the floor to introduce yourself and to explain what this book is, why you wrote it. And at the end, we'll mention how people can get it, etc.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that incredibly generous introduction. That's very kind. I'm glad that you found it so easy to read. That was one of my ambitions trying to write it, that I wanted it to be as accessible as it could be. I mean, it is, I think, still a quite relatively scholarly book, but I hope that someone who doesn't know that much about Marx will be able to read it. But anyway, thank you for those kind words. So who am I? I work at the London School of Economics in London, as the name suggests. I've been here for quite a number of years. I work in political theory, history of political thought. I guess Marx is probably one of my central research interests. I'm also kind of interested in democratic theory, and that's one of my newer interests. Maybe we can talk about that later. I don't know, is there more details you'd like to give, I should give it all?
Well, I suppose you say at one of the point, you know, in the introduction to the book, you say that, quote, this book is written in the spirit that there is much to be gained from studying Marxist thought in its historical context. And if you permit me to make an argument that you don't have to defend or support if you don't want to, I think there's a sort of problem that's very common on the left where folks reify or dehistoricize political thought into a kind of Platonic ideal of theory, such that there are like capital R reformists and capital R revolutionaries, and there's republicanism to one side and communism and anarchism and all these isms. And I mean, I've even heard people make arguments that speak of the Popular Front in, you know, capital letters, as if there's one, you know, abstract ideal of the Popular Front that is instantiated through history. And I personally, as someone with a more Foucauldian background, I find that ridiculous. And I found your text very helpful because you discuss Marx's work in the context of his own time with the theoretical apparatus that he would have been working with as a young journalist in, you know, Prussia and Saxony and all this stuff. So if you want to explain maybe how you historicize Marx and also why that's politically useful, because I think really what makes this book so useful and why I wanted to talk to you about it on the show isn't just an intellectual argument, but there's really a lot here that's going to change how people are going to approach this history and these texts and think about democracy and socialism and these topics, I think, in a new light that has an impact on our actual political practice.
I'm very glad you picked up on this theme of like this, well, the kind of methodological commitment of the book, right, which is this placing Marx in his historical context. And it was and is very important to me because, I mean, I'm generally committed to that kind of approach doing the history of political thought. I think it's a very fruitful way to do political thought, and it's very important so that we don't, you know, if we're going to learn something from the history of political thought, I think it's one way that it's very important is that we don't just go back with what we already believe, right? And then just impose it onto whatever author we're reading, because we don't really need the author, we don't need to do the history for that, right? Then it becomes just a kind of foil for what we were already planning to do. And I think if this kind of history of political thought is going to be provide us with something, then it can help as much as we are able to try and reconstruct what those texts were trying to do at the time in which they were written. What were the intentions of the author in writing that text? And that is, for me, why, you know, contextualism, historicization isn't a depoliticizing move. I think that can easily be what people might think. And that's certainly the way some people do it. Like some of the recent biographies of Marx, for example, they have this explicit thing. We're going to put Marx back into the 19th century, and then he's safely in the 19th century and has nothing more to say for us in the 21st century. That's not at all the way that I think about contextualism. For me, I'm placing him in that historical context in order to try and understand what kind of political actor Marx was in his day. Who was he trying to ally with, oppose, and what difference was he trying to make? And in that way, I hope that we can find resources that might in some way surprise us for today, for socialist thought on the left, that we might not necessarily get if we just went to Marx with what we already believe, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. And I would say that, you know, for folks who are just figuring out that this book exists, it's supposed to come out next week in America and, you know, early next year in the rest of the world, I guess. And the book is divided into three parts. So you have three different senses of the concept of republic elaborated. There's the democratic republic, the bourgeois republic, and the social republic. And earlier this year, I was trying to explain, you know, to an international audience what was going on in France with the snap elections and the sort of confrontation of, you know, all the polls saying that the far right is going to win and come to power. And then there was the New Popular Front that came and actually came in the lead instead. And there was this discourse about the social republic, which to many, you know, Anglophone ears are not sure what that means, basically. And if you go back and read in like Auguste Blanqui, he's also talking about the social republic. And I think a lot of people have lost this history that you're uncovering, or you're highlighting, I should say, with this text, because when you talk to folks about a figure like Blanqui, he's often treated as an anarchist or as purely interested in like armed struggle. But when you read his text or study his biography, I mean, he was a candidate for elected office. He was a state official. He was constantly talking about the Republic in all of his writings. And we can say that's rhetoric or whatever. I don't want to like drag you into a long exegesis of Blanqui. I just think when we actually study these figures of the 19th century in context, they don't fit into the categories, as you say, that people want to force them into. And so I guess with Marx in particular, you know, given this approach, given the importance of Marx in the history of political thought, if you could kind of summarize, what do you want to do? What do you want the book to do in the world today? That would be interesting. And then we can talk about the elements of the book in detail.
Yeah. Yeah, that's quite a nice way around. I think, because I mean, in the book, I do it, you know, the kind of what I think it might offer us today is kind of like the final few pages. So in some ways, it's a, yeah, getting right to the end. And then we can talk more about the Marx afterwards. I have two hopes for the book. And in terms of what resources it might offer for socialist thinking today, socialist politics today. And I emphasize the word resources because I find that that's a more capacious understanding rather than, let's say, lessons. Lessons to me always suggest a very kind of like direct linear kind of thing. And I don't think my book provides that, and I wouldn't want it to provide that. I think it just provides maybe ways of thinking that might be helpful, that can be developed further. And so the first one is, I guess, a point about politics. And so I guess what I hope comes out of this study of Marx and republicanism is that Marx, in fact, cared very deeply about political institutions, what they should look like, what shape they should have, and that they should have this radically democratic republican structure. You know, he talks about various means to make representatives more accountable, to make public administration like something that's carried out by the people themselves. And that way, you know, you just transform the state and government. And that's very important to me because I think, I guess, that, you know, socialism has had a problem in various different guises of treating politics as in some way a secondary concern, that, you know, is something that doesn't need great thought out in detail. It's just, you know, of the vehicle that we use for socialist transformation. And I think that has been a very wrongheaded socialist legacy. Obviously, there have always been socialists that have not believed that and have pushed against that kind of political instrumentalism. But, you know, you see it all the way from, let's say, the technocratic views of the Fabians or the more authoritarian instantiation with Stalinism. All of these are kind of ways in which I think politics was not given its proper due in a way. And like the political shape of the of a socialist society wasn't given proper weight in that way. And so that is one resource that I hope the book provides, is that we actually have a history there of taking politics more seriously than some later history might suggest otherwise. Then the second resource I hope it provides is on the idea of freedom. So one thing I try to show through the book is that I think Marx has a commitment to what is called republican freedom, which is where you're free when there's no one who dominates you, right? So That means that there's no one who has uncontrolled power over you, that they can do whatever they please with you, they can interfere with you as they wish, and you have no kind of countervailing power of them. And that's, I think, a more encompassing vision of freedom than I think the one that is standard today, which is a much more, you might say, a libertarian version of freedom, that you're just free whenever, no one interferes with you, when the state leaves you alone. And that's not Republican freedom. And I think you can use Republican freedom for some really interesting critiques of, let's say, workplace domination, right? The way in which an employer has this arbitrary power over you, right? I think it's also an important thing for the left and left constitutionalism, because it opens our eyes to the idea that, that we need rules that people can control and shape themselves. So it's that dual thing, that it's that power can be shaped in a certain way to make it non-dominating. And that we can then use it for a critique of the way in which the political system dominates you, the social spheres are dominated, beyond the workplace as well, various kind of been very influential in feminist circles as well. And so I think that vision of freedom is something that I think is waiting for socialists to reclaim, because I think too often we talk in terms solely in terms of equality or fraternity, which I think are important values, or solidarity, but I think freedom is often, we leave it to our opponents in a way. And I think that we should reclaim it.
And after all, as Marx himself said, freedom is the species being of all spiritual existence.
Yes, exactly. I think it's really underestimated just how much he really, freedom is his central political and normative value.
Well, I will say that I think there's a kind of obvious argument, or a sort of point people might raise when reading this book, is that, we spend a lot of time with the young Marx. Like, we talk a lot of time about Marx as a young journalist. And I think there might be a kind of reading of this book that would say, oh, well, Leopold is taking all his time with this immature spiritual stuff, right? Whereas the mature Marx, doesn't believe in that or whatever. What would your kind of response to such an argument be? Because I think that's kind of what a lot of people, or at least that's what I thought when I was reading this. I was like, okay, yeah, he said that when he was like 25, or you know what I mean? But what is the mature Marx? Or
Sure.
are these multiple thinkers, or is this really one sense of thought that was developed over time?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say that I don't think there's a single mature Marx in that sense, because I also think that, as I argue in the book, you mentioned there's three phases of Marx's relationship to republicanism, which is what structures my book. And so, there's, just to be brief, in the first phase, Marx, I argue that Marx is a republican, just straightforwardly. The second phase is when Marx has converted to communism, but that conversion to communism integrates all kinds of republican commitments. And then there's a third phase, which comes with the Paris Commune, where I think Marx has a fuller integration of republicanism. And I think those two mature phases, if we were to call them that, have some differences in them. And so, what I guess, so your question was about, about continuities. Is this just only there in the young Marx? And I guess that would be, is really a view that I'm trying to push against, because, over half of the book is not to do with the young Marx. I think the book deals a lot with the young Marx's thought, because that is when he is straightforwardly a Republican. So that obviously is a reason. But I do actually think that we pay too much attention to the young Marx, if that. On the whole, in the sense that I do think Marx's most interesting works are clearly his mature works. I mean, I really wish that people would teach and read Capital much more than the 1844 manuscripts, for instance. So, I mean, if you're taught Marx, if at all, let's say at a UK university, in a philosophy department, for instance, or a politics department, very likely that you'll be taught the 1844 manuscripts, and Capital will never be opened. And I think that's a major mistake. I think it's just clearly Capital is Marx's masterpiece. And the fact that it's just so under-taught, because, well, I guess it's a little bit, it's a longer work, of course, right? It's
It's
harder
a
to read.
long work, and it's also like famously hard for people that aren't scholars or whatever to get into. I mean, how many reading groups do we know that have bombed out, you
Sure.
know?
Yeah, I mean, there is
Do you have
no.
an opinion on the new translation, by the way?
Not yet, because actually, now that you mention it, I actually just joined a reading group for it. That well, we
Okay,
just
very
joined. We
good.
had our first initial meeting, and we're going to start in the new year. And then I'll have a view. But I mean, my initial view is I'm very excited that it exists, and I'm glad that it exists. And I, until I started reading it, I can't really know. But I think that I mean, there's been some people who I respect. William Clare Roberts was involved in the project, and I think that, and I've got every reason to believe that it will, in fact, be a very good translation. And I, at least, I, you know, I've read some of the editorial matter, and one thing that they're committed to is really making a readable Marx that captures kind of his literary brilliance that comes across in German and doesn't always come across in the translation. And I'm very glad that that is one of their animating principles. So that makes me quite excited to read it.
Yeah, I have not read it all the way myself. I just started it, as you said. And my sort of goal is I'm going to read it and then read the volume one of the. Do you remember which year off? Was it the 1872? Which was the French edition that he authorized?
Yeah, that's so the French edition, if I remember rightly, come is serialized from like 72 to 74, 75 or so. And the
Yeah,
German
something like
edition and
this.
second German edition is 72. I mean, I would say that I
As you
see.
can see from tout à l'heure, I'm not exactly strong with dates and years, so I don't want to butcher too many of them. But basically, I want to read back to back the French and the New English and see how it goes, because I don't speak German, so
Right. Well,
that's my limit.
but you've also, in a way, got a bit of advantage in a way, because the French, as the quote, the famous quote from Marx, semi-famous quote from Marx, that the French edition has its own scientific value, right? I think is what he says. I can't remember.
Yes, exactly.
And I think that's true. Having like, I haven't read it in French, but I've dipped into parts of it in French to kind of check where there might be differences. And there are some really interesting differences, and they're worth engaging with. And if I was to say anything, I'd say that it's, I mean, they have reasons for why they chose the 72 edition, and I think they're quite respectable. But it's a shame that we don't also have an English translation of the French edition, because I do think there's a lot that Marx changed there that I think is really, is quite are valuable changes. And in a way we were quite well served with the previous English translation, the Ben Fokes translation in Penguin, because that did at least follow the chapter structure of the French edition, which I think is an improved chapter structure on the German edition. But this is getting quite into the
Yeah,
nitty-gritty.
we're getting deeper into Capital, but I think it's important that we talk about this because, as you said, there's too much emphasis put on the young Marx and sort of like latter 20th century, early 21st century discussions of Marx. But you're forced to go there because you have to talk about his intellectual development. You have to make an argument about his intellectual development that leads to a conclusion of, as you said, an integrated republicanism with his communist vision. So I guess to put it to you this way, I typically, when I talk to people about my politics, I would say that I'm a Republican and a communist. I would just say I'm both. And when I think about it to myself, I just think that communism is a form of republicanism. Like, I just think it's a sort of development of it in the 20th and 21st century because, Machiavelli, who you talk about a little bit in the book, didn't spend a lot of time critiquing political economy, but he's a Republican, And if we go back to Plato, I mean, the whole debate in the Republic begins with a kind of utopian communalism that was rejected by the heady young men who wanted dancing girls and, drinking and power and war and all these things. So for me, republicanism is something that evolves over time. It's not a static set of like ideas, if that makes sense. It's a living political tradition of which communism is like the contemporary sort of point of the spear, so to speak. But do you see republicanism and communism more as parallel or intersecting, or maybe explain the relation as you see it between these two things?
Well, I mean, I guess we'd have to differentiate between what is republicanism in some trans-historical sense and what does it mean specifically in Marx's time in the 19th century. Because, I mean, of course, if we're asking in the kind of that broader level and also what it means today, you can also make an argument that in France, republicanism is the state ideology from which conservative, liberal, and socialist slash communist politics draw inspiration, right? You can
Yeah,
also
I would
make
say
that
that.
kind of argument as
Yeah.
well. I guess, and then once, of course, if you go further back in history than the 19th century, there's a whole other story that, you need to take in a whole bunch of various different contexts in which Republican thought emerges. I just to maybe speak specifically about republicanism in the 19th century, because that's really what I'm trying to do in the book is I could have gone in with and just said, this is what republicanism is on the basis of what contemporary political theory says republicanism is, right? It's a
Yeah.
set of concepts X, Y, Z, and we just look for those concepts back in Marx's writings or something. And that was, I guess, the the approach I took when I first did the project, when I was like a young PhD student. And as I got drawn in, I realized just how inadequate that was, or I think is an inadequate way to do it. And instead, what I ended up doing is try to reconstruct, what was republicanism at that moment in the sense of it being an ideology attached to a political formation. And I don't mean ideology in the Marxist sense here. I mean ideology in the sense of, the set of concepts that animate a particular political formation and are kind of combined and given certain certain definition and have a kind of a certain kind of coherence to them.
Which is why you only speak about really the 19th century. Like, you don't go into early 20th century. And you also, it broke my heart, but I understand, did not talk about like Robespierre.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think that if you're going to do this kind of contextualism about an ideology, it has to be really quite place and time specific, right? I mean, even then, I'm not even discussing 19th century republicanism. I'm really discussing 19th century European republicanism, right? Which, I mean that, of course, there's Latin American republicanisms, American republicanisms. There's work on the Ottoman republicanism, for instance. And I'm not denying any of the validity of those things. I'm just saying that I'm looking at the thing that most influenced at Marx and which that he most interacted with. And
And
that
that's
is
what makes it a scientific work, is you're very precise. You're much more precise than me when I try to explain like who I am to somebody. That's not really a scientific endeavor. That's like a matter of political expression and rhetoric more than it is a scientific. And I would say that this work, it does, it's very concrete in talking about, he spoke to this English guy and he talked to that German guy, and all the details in the book. So if people are listening to this and think that we're sweeping over the details, I mean, it's what, like 400 and some 440 pages or something?
It's a little bit. I'm quite embarrassed as to how long it became. It was not meant to be that long. It was a bit of a
I just
shock.
want people to know, if you think that I'm like brought, running through the details here, you have the whole book to go through them all. But when it comes to the Republic, I mean, you talk about three different senses of Republic. So for you in the 19th century, what we have is we have a specific European Republican political ideology, right? Which is in evolution. That's another important thing to that you kind of outline. So do you want to talk about that evolution, and then we can get to Marx in particular?
I mean, I've got to say, I wish I had done a better job of showing some of the evolution of republicanism. I think that in the 19th century, I think that that would require its own study, because I think that there are so many moments across which in the 19th century republicanism also shifts. And I think I hope I give some sense of it, but I think an even better job could be done of it. I mean, republicanism after 1848 has to make some has to change after the Paris Commune has to change, right? I mean, the way in which it becomes a state ideology towards the end of the 19th century in France, these kinds of things, which I don't deal could well, that's post-Marx really, so I don't deal so much with that. Certainly, I mean, republicanism has to come to grips more and more with the fact that the underlying political economy is changing, if we were to get a bit Marxist about it, in the sense that, so
Yeah,
one
of
thing I
course.
do try to discuss in the book is that I think republicanism has real purchase in the 19th century as a radical ideology because it speaks to artisans, really. And so if we think of artisans as, those workers who, if we're doing somewhat in a somewhat ideal type analysis, have own their own tools or are their own yeah, so they own their own means of production, basically, right? Whereas proletarians in this ideal analysis don't, right? And they work for someone else. And so one of the things that we forget is that the working class of Europe the great majority of them are artisans for a really long time into the 19th century. So I mean, the statistics are crazy that it's not until I think the 1880s, I want to say, in France, where the proletarian working class overtakes the artisan working class. And in France and in England, like the center of industrialism, it's not until 1850. So in a lot of ways, there's another way in which Marx is actually talking about a world that doesn't yet exist. Which
And
is
that's important for people to remember. The proletariat in his time was a minority of people, even within Europe. Globally, it was a sliver of the population.
entirely, and it's one of Marx's most accurate and most forgotten predictions. I mean, Marx predicted something's wrong, but on this, he's entirely accurate that the growth of wage labor was going to be the great transformation in employment relations. That is very, any statistics over the next 100, 150 years will show you that, right? Of course, there are small fluctuations when there are slight increases in petty bourgeois classes, but on the whole, that is the big transformation that you get people being driven off the land and being driven from being artisans into being wage earners.
And over this period, if I can just help some of the listeners that don't have the book in front of them or aren't familiar with the history, basically we have the, you know, the French Revolution, which we can think of as like two mini revolutions or more, I guess you can schematize it as you want. But these sort of set up a framework that the 19th century is going to be developing in, where we have this, you know, Declaration of Rights of Man, and then Declaration of Rights of Man, the better version in 1793. And then we have the reaction. And so people like, you know, a generation before, I guess, more or less Marx would be somebody like Blanqui, who is growing up with this Republican idea, not as like a Thomas More utopian fantasy, but like this existed. There was a revolution and there was a republic, and then it was defeated and turned into an empire and a kingdom. And so a lot of people are, you know, going to be talking about, you know, we want bread and the constitution of the year two, you know, or the year one. And then on the other side, you have, you know, the utopians who are doing their kind of anti-political or parallel political experiments, right? So could you maybe like frame how that republicanism evolved through the 19th century?
Yes. So I think that's, I mean, that would be the other thing. If one were to tell a fuller story of 19th century republicanism, it would really have to be a long 19th century, you know, to use the it would have to start with 1789 and go all the way up, let's say maybe to the First World War. Because I think, and, you know, I don't fully tell that story because I basically pick up republicanism at the point in which Marx comes onto the scene, which is 1840 or so. But there is then this previous history, which you really interestingly highlight, which is, you know, this, well, the republicanism that emerges on a mass scale during the French Revolution, right? And then is, you know, essentially forced to go underground in a lot of ways, right? Once Napoleon wins, once, you know, the Vienna Congress and reaction wins in 1814, 1815. And, you know, Europe goes through a very reactionary phase in France and in Germany. And there I would love to see, I don't know of a very good single work that really traces that in the way in which these networks, to some extent were destroyed by secret police and so forth, but also I think continue to exist. I mean, so republicanism really becomes something of a, you know, an underground society kind of movement, I suppose, during this period. I mean,
I'm very indebted to your colleague, Peter Holloward, doing the Blanqui stuff, for like making the Blanqui stuff more accessible.
Right? I believe
Look at something like Lamartine, you know, refusing the red flag, unless you have all this history, none of this makes sense. You don't see the political contours developing. Like for me, Lamartine refusing the red flag is like the birth of the conflict. You know, that's like the beginning of the conflict of republicanism and socialism, where people like Blanqui afterward will say, like, they took, you know, liberty, equality, fraternity from us. They took the republic from us. But in their stupidity, they rejected the red flag, which is still ours, you know. And it's just, for me, it's such a fascinating thing, which, like, frankly, as a, you know, American militant, I never studied any of this. I never knew any about it. History began with 1917, Bruno. Don't you know that?
There is just this much older radical heritage that I really think is, you know, I think, you know, this transformation of republican socialism out of republicanism from 1789. I mean, that is, I think, a story that still needs to be told a little bit in a way.
Your next book can do that, and then you can do the Second International.
There's so much nice work that's been done on the Second International from like individual thinkers and their relationship to republicanism. I'm thinking, for example, some work, James Muldoon, Tom O'Shea, Camilla Vergara, who've all done, you know, things on like, you know, Kautsky, Gramsci, Luxembourg and some of their Republican influences. I think Republicanism in the Second International would be a book that I would love to read. I don't think I'm the person to write it, but I would love for someone to take on that project.
It was only recently that I learned, because like Jean Jaurès just isn't translated in English very much.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, Jean, he would be a massive figure in this story, of course. Yeah.
And I only recently learned that in the sort of debates, because Jean Jaurès had perfect German and did his like PhD on German philosophy and German idealism and everything. And, you know, he was involved on the side of Rosa Luxemburg in arguments about there needs to be a German Republic. which was not at all a consensus view. And a lot of these figures that we would put, you know, to go back to the beginning of the why the historicist approach is interesting, when you do like a conceptual schema-based view where you put like ideas in a plane and this ism with that ism, you wouldn't really expect Luxembourg and Jaurès to be allies in particular debates, I think. Yeah. That would be like surprising to people.
Yeah, I did. I didn't know about Jaurès's German links in that way, but that's, I haven't read as much on the Second International as I would like to. I mean, I don't know if there, would you say, is there a good synthetic overview of like all of its, you know, component French, Russian, German?
No, that's the thing is I'm like, because, you know, I've been getting better in French over the last few years to the point where I speak fluently and I, you know, can read all the texts and understand them. And it's just, there's simply texts that don't exist like in the English literature, just as like your book, I hope will come out in French. You know, I think your book would be very useful to the French audience and to kind of recenter the discussion and what we were talking about a moment ago. And sorry if this is too shambolic, I can edit things around or whatever, but we were talking about, you know, 1789, the post-Napoleonic, you know, reactionary period, the rebirth of, you know, left-wing republicanism, socialism, the sort of underground movement that starts to fracture, where people start to think about these things as different, is about the same moment where Marx is, you know, growing up, I guess. I mean, this is the moment where he is sort of coming onto the stage. And this is really where your book begins, with him as a young student, even, you know, writing papers about, you know, classical antiquity. So maybe take us from this sort of beginning of the split, which I'm going to say is Lamartine, but you can disagree with me, obviously. So take us from there through Marx, and then we'll come back with like the obvious questions that people are going to raise.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, yeah, let's start with 1842. So 1842 is the year in which Marx enters the public sphere, I suppose we can say, right? This is when his first public writings appear. You know, he's just finished his PhD. He's tried to become an academic, but that is closed to him because of Prussian repression, right? So they're starting to crack down on what is known as I don't know if your readers will be familiar with young Hegel, but not readers, listeners.
Yeah, we can talk about young Hegelianism and stuff
sure.
like that. That's fine.
And so that's kind of close to him. So he turns to journalism, right? Which, insofar as Marx has a profession, is his profession for the rest of his life, right? That is how he makes what little money he makes. Although he makes more money at the beginning, I think, than he does later. I think he's a bit more. But that also is a reflection of the repressive time. But anyway, that's by the by. So he comes onto the scene in 1842. And what do we need to know about what's going on there? So this is in the Rhineland, in the far west of Prussia. And the Rhineland is an interesting province because, you know, some of your French listeners know it briefly belongs to France. So Napoleon annexes it. I don't remember when he annexes it, but it's some 15 years or so it's under French control. And so it gets some of this kind of like, you know, the limited form of emancipation that exists under Napoleon. So they get the Napoleonic Code and so forth. That means that Marx's father, who's Jewish, can practice law and these kinds of things. So it has this kind of, I don't know if liberalism is the right word, but it has a kind of liberalization that goes on under, I guess, a certain amount of authoritarianism. The Rhineland gets added to Prussia. And, you know, Prussia is a much, you know, very authoritarian and backward state, right? It, you know, just remains an absolute monarchy. And, you know, in a lot of ways, its rule is quite unpopular in the Rhineland. And that's important for understanding Marx, because despite, you know, being a Prussian citizen, he has this, you know, slightly, let's say, yeah, this kind of more French background and not French background, but you see what I'm saying. But there is a slightly more liberal atmosphere that's available to him. And that's where he grows up. And in 1842, I think in a way there's basically no such thing as socialism in Germany in 1842, right? It's just about to start making an appearance, right? The first writings start appearing, Wilhelm Weitling, Moses Hess and so forth, right? It's just, but really it's not on the political agenda really at that point, right? Politics is, you know, much more dominated by kind of a liberal opposition to absolute monarchy. And then a kind of liberal Republican split, right? About the question about how democratic any alternative to absolute monarchy should be. And what I argue is that when Marx enters the public sphere, he is a Republican, right? So he says that privately. He's already, you know, dissatisfied with liberalism, thinks it doesn't go far enough, it's not sufficient in various ways. But
As
he's
would all revolutionaries of that time.
Yeah, of course, right?
Like, by 1792, people know that liberalism doesn't go far enough.
Sure, yes, yeah.
I mean, if you read, and this is something I really recommend to people, I don't know if this has been translated into English. Was there a translation of all of Robespierre's like papers into English or not?
I mean, if there is, I
Like
don't
his
know about.
proposition of laws and stuff?
I mean, that I'm would be surprised if there isn't a translation, but
Well,
there's
anyway,
going.
in the address when he proposes the Declaration of Rights of Man, number two, right? He says, like, you know, you talked about property when we did the first, you know, one of these, but you didn't advance certain questions correctly, or you didn't advance them far enough, right? And so it's like, even in one lifetime, people did this, understood this problem. And I think, and tell me if I'm being ahistorical, but from like 1792 to 1848, that would have been just understood by all like actual revolutionaries in Europe, no?
Yeah, I think so. Although,
that 1789 isn't enough.
Yeah, I mean, that is one argument for what becomes Republican socialism, that it kind of makes this kind of simplified version of history where it's like 1789 is our political emancipation, and now we need to have a social emancipation as well on top of it. It's a bit complicated because, of course, actually there were a whole bunch of social ideas discussed in the French Revolution as well, but there is that kind of narrative that gets told, as it were.
Yeah.
Maybe so. What I was saying on Marx and when he, so, but yeah. So yes. So he is a private Republican, but he's also, you know, he's a political realist. He knows what is possible at that moment, and so there is very heavy government censorship at the time in which Marx enters the political sphere. And this is, I think, is just maybe not appreciated enough that you know, everything that Marx wants to publish in the newspaper, when he's a journalist, when he's an editor in the Rhineland, has to be checked by a censor beforehand. You send it to the censor on the evening of publication. They look through it. They send back their cuts, literally cuts, right, with scissors going through.
Yeah.
And that's what you're then allowed to publish. So you've got to be really careful about what you do, because, you know, if you keep pushing it too far, the censor might recommend that the whole newspaper is shut down, the government comes down on you. So Marx is really clear that we can't, like, openly call for a republic, which some other Republicans at the time are doing. So slightly more radical, well, ultra radical might be the better term. Young Hegelians are doing that, right? In the same
paper.
If
you want to go to prison for your whole life like Blanqui, that's one way to do it.
That, yeah, and I mean, the sad thing about Blanqui is, of course, that he's in prison at all the wrong moments, right?
Yeah, of course.
In 1848, in the Paris Commune. Well, I don't want to, like, you know, be too harsh on Blanqui. You know, there, you know, he fought, you know, he made very important sacrifices. But yeah, so Marx is trying to be more realistic. He wants this newspaper to survive, the Rheinische Zeitung. So he wants to push up at the very limit of what is possible that you can get away with in the censor, but not cross that line, as it were. And so you get a kind of private republicanism, public liberalism a little bit with Marx, because liberalism is about all that Prussia is willing to accept. It's willing to have some criticisms around the rule of law and things like this. It's definitely not going to countenance democracy, right? That it, or, you know, or the removal of the monarch or something like this, all things that republicanism is associated with. So Marx has got to be quite careful about that, but, you know, you still get some of his republican sympathies coming through in the writings, and I kind of separate that out, and I think that's a little bit different to maybe what some other people have written. So some people just look at the journalism and go, this is liberalism. And I think that's just people not having a full comprehension of the political subtleties of the different formations at that time. And I think that's where this contextual approach can help us to see the differences.
And you do. I mean, one of the details you talk about in the opening chapter of the book is the chapters of the book is this idea that, you know, one ruler could call to another ruler and say, hey, use your censor to shut this. I mean, there was not just one authority, but multiple authorities that he had to contend with.
Yeah, no, indeed, right? And I mean, there are just all different aspects of arbitrary power at that time.
You mentioned something in passing that I would like you to elaborate briefly, which is, we've talked about like socialism, which I think most people know what that is. Republicanism, which we've discussed, is this particular historical ideology or trajectory or whatever. And then democracy, in this sense, means popular sovereignty. It means the people being the actor of political life.
Yeah.
Or no?
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I'm What I guess I would try. So when I say that democracy, let's say, is very important to republicanism, it's very important to Marx throughout the book and the what I'm saying. I don't want to be misunderstood that I mean democracy, what we understand by it today, I suppose. So I guess what I think what we call democracy today is better called representative government. That's an idea that I take from Bernard Menard, a very influential French political and constitutional thinker who died recently. And what was meant by democracy in the 19th century was, I think, a lot more democratic, if you will. So, of course, it meant universal suffrage, by which, they say universal suffrage, but they mostly mean manhood suffrage. So there is actually certainly that limitation, but there were also Republicans who argued for women's suffrage as well. So it means that that's, one thing we associate with democracy today, but it meant so much more than that to them as well. So for one thing, they did not think that, the way we think of democracy today, that, you vote and that's all you do for the next 4 years, right? And then you get to vote again, right? So Republicans thought that, that the representatives you vote for should be tightly controlled by the people, right? There should be mechanisms that mean that they can't just do what they want for those intervening 4 years, right? They also thought that, elections weren't sufficient, right? There should be elections. They believed in representation, but there should also be a whole bunch of other forms of political participation available to citizens, formal avenues of political participation. And in those ways and other ways, I think what they meant by democracy was just, yeah, much more expansive than what we understand by that term today.
And in this context, I mean, if you want to be a liberal Republican at the time that Marx is beginning his work, you would be saying something like, we need a mixed constitution that is, has formally enshrined the rule of law, and there has to be balances of power. That would be like a liberal Republican reading. Whereas a social Republican, if we can say that a social Republican exists in this moment, which I'm not sure it does, but let's say it does exist, a social Republican would be more of a Jacobin. We need delegates who are recallable, and the people have to be, sovereign alone with no other authority, other than that which has basically been divinely revealed, as Robespierre would say.
Yeah, I mean, you're very right to bring up these complications because I've been talking a little bit about liberalism separately, republicanism separately, socialism separately. And there's certainly, if we just take re liberal republicanism first, that does exist, right? I would say it's primarily something that exists in France. I wouldn't talk much about the idea of liberal republicanism in Germany or something, but in France, you do get like a bourgeois or moderate or liberal republican faction. Let's say in 1848, and in the years before it, right? And I guess they're in some ways quite an interesting, I don't deal with them so much in my book because they're less relevant to the story about Marx, but they are, I think, quite an interesting formation because you could argue in some ways they're the winning ideology in a way, because what they did is that they combined the democratic or some of the democratic claims of republicanism, universal suffrage particularly, to a kind of more broader liberal framework about. As you mentioned, mixed constitution, checks and balances, or something like that, and that becomes the dominant political architecture for representative government that we still live under today, right? Whereas, let's say, liberals at the time who were not Republicans did not believe in democracy, so they had to be persuaded to become Democrats over the 19th century, and then Republicans who were not didn't have that liberal that more liberal moderate inflection, had a more, as I say, a more encompassing sense of democracy. So, in some sense, it was that middle path liberal republicanism that won out. So, again, if someone were to tell a fuller story of 19th century republicanism, that would, I think, be quite an interesting narrative that would have to be part of it as well.
So for Marx, as this, young, superficially liberal, but secretly, or not so secretly, sort of subtly Republican figure, what pushes him to move beyond that? Is it just the level of repression? Is what to summarize that kind of trajectory of his life, what would push him from that position to the Marx that became, the world historic figure we know today?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. He's actually not, in some ways, not so successful with this secret republicanism because one of the government ministers writes in his notes when he's shutting down Marx's newspaper that Marx is, an ultra democrat with principles completely opposed to the Prussian state. So he wasn't, in some ways, completely successful with his strategy. And indeed, the newspaper is shut down. And you might just argue either that Marx wasn't successful or that just the space for the strategy just didn't fully exist, right, when Prussia became authoritarian. And so how does then Marx start to shift? Well, so one thing is, of course, when the newspaper shut down and he kind of retreats to a spa town, Kreuznach, he marries his longtime fiancée, Jenny von Westphalen, and he takes a moment to kind of write a little bit more abstractly, philosophically, and he writes a critique of Hegel, the quite well-known critique of Hegel's views on the state, which I argue are kind of a much more explicit republicanism than in his journalism, because it's just an unpublished piece of writing. And from there, he goes to Paris, where he's going to set up his next journalistic venture. This is the Deutsch-Französische Jahrbücher. So him and a collaborator called Arnold Rugger had this idea that it's really important to bring French and German together in a, what they call, you know, a Franco-German scientific alliance is what they call it.
But there was some kind of problem. You mentioned the book. I kind of forget the detail, but he didn't speak French good enough or something. There was some kind of issue with
the
French aspect didn't quite work out.
Well, so the problem is that the French just don't really get what they're on about in a lot of ways. So they try and get all of these French collaborators and they completely fail. When the first issue of the journal appears, it's just Germans. And, you know, there's a couple of different reasons for that. One reason is that they're atheists. And this doesn't play well in France at the moment at all, even on the left, really. So that's one thing. And young Hegelianism is not very well understood. So I'm thinking of Daniel Stern, you know, the pseudonym for Marie Dogo. You know, she kind of reviews what they're doing, these young Hegelians who've arrived in Paris in 1840, at the end of 1843. And she's like, yeah, I mean, I don't really get their language. What are these guys going on about this, you know, Le Jeune École Hegelienne? You know, she's just like, what are these guys talking about? So they're not, they kind of fail in that sense. But the journal itself is very interesting. I mean, there's some very foundational pieces that are published in there. There's Marx's On the Jewish Question, his critique of Hegel, introduction.
Is this when he did his glowing reviews of Carlyle, or is that later?
So that's Engels, if I remember rightly. That I think that one of the pieces appears also in the Deutsch-Französische Jahrbücher, and there's also a piece in there by Engels, which is an attempt to deal with political economy, and that may be Marx's first exposure to political economy. It might be the spark that makes him think, "Oh crap, I really need to read into this literature." So it's a hugely important journal. It's in Paris that I argue that this really the transition from republicanism to communism comes about. And it's soon after the publication of that journal. So Marx has, you know, at least in so the personal story is that he has a falling out with Arnold Rugger, his Republican collaborator. And one of the things that Marx says supposedly in this argument, we only have Rugger's side of the story. The letter that Marx wrote announcing their breakup hasn't survived. But it says, you know, that, you know, you are just a politician, whereas I am a communist. Right. So that is, you know, the moment, it's I think March or so, 1844, that Marx is making this explicit, you know, statement that I am part of this new movement, new ideology. Of course, there are signs that that's coming beforehand. There are, you know, even within, you know, his, you know, the critique of Hegel the year before. But I'd say it's a bit different to say that there are signs beforehand to saying that to the difference of him actually making that commitment. I do think that there's something important about when someone explicitly says, I have now, you know, changed my ideology in a way. I've had it.
Yeah, you should take that seriously. Normally when people profess a change in ideology.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, Marx is not the only person to be doing this at this point, right? A lot of people are making that transition. So Engels writes an article at the time where he explicitly says, Marx is one of the people who's moved from republicanism to communism, right? And he uses those terms. So this is not an imposition, this republican language, right? You know, Engels is saying this is what is going on in young Hegelianism. He's actually wrong, Engels, at that moment. Marx hasn't become a communist at the particular moment that he's writing, but Marx is a few months away from making.
Yeah, Engels is jumping the gun. Would you say this is the same moment when they make their anti-political turn?
Oh, so this is interesting. It adds a bit of a complication to the overall story.
I would say that as reading in this, it's like everything is like pretty easy to expect, and then you get this kind of. We have this like little derive of anti-politics.
Yes. And I think that's because in some ways I came to the conclusion that there is something of an anti-political moment quite late in my research, I would say. But it's also because it's just not entirely clear in the case of Marx. So maybe for the listeners, what I mean by this is that for me, it's very important that when I'm telling the kind of high level story, that Marx's transition from republicanism to communism involves a incorporation of a republican commitment to politics and democracy into communism. That's the high level story, right?
Yeah.
But there is a kind of in-between dip, if you will, where it seems it's possible that Marx endorses some of the more anti-political aspects of existing communism before making that more republican incorporation. Now, if you were to tell the story of Engels's transition to communism, and I hope that someone writes Citizen Engels at some point as a
you should write it.
Well, maybe
you should write all of these books we've been talking about.
Just it could be
drink more coffee, man.
What are you
waiting for?
Well, I already drink too much. So Engels's transition, I think, is fascinating in itself, and I think someone should write it. And there, this anti-political, anti-democratic moment is completely explicit. You know, Engels says very clear. So he starts off as a Republican when he travels over to England. He's very keen about the Chartists. He's, you know, things. And but then he becomes very interested, influenced by Owenism. And then he takes on these very, very anti-political, anti-democratic views. So, you know, he says that democracy is the rule of the majority coercing the minority. And that's unacceptable. You know, the majority doesn't know how to rule. We actually need to have technocrats in charge. Right. He literally says this. And he says, and he even has this really crazy idea, the idea that this technocratic administration could be run by whoever writes the best prize essay. Incredibly naive, right? But that's Engels even. I think that's how widespread this anti-politics is in early socialism, right? That even Engels is convinced by it. And I discussed that quite at length in the book. And so I guess, yeah, so getting back to this anti-political moment. So for Marx, the evidence base, and we're really only talking about the space of a very short, sharp months, I would say, towards the end of 1844 to the beginning of 1845, where Marx writes particularly one article, the first article that he writes, I think, as a communist, which is a critique of Ruger. I think that there is some evidence that Marx has quite a few kind of anti-political themes, quite very skeptical of the need of for a republic at all. He still kind of endorses a revolution, but not really. It's very unclear what he thinks, how the transition to socialism might come about, which is very typical of a kind of strain of German socialism at the time. What is Marx and Engels later go on to call true socialism. So some of your listeners who are kind of more kind of read a bit more about Marx might know this term, true socialism. It's one of the forms of socialism that they critique in the Communist Manifesto. And actually, the term true socialism is actually one that Marx and Engels create. So it's actually not something that, you know, the true socialists themselves use at all. It's something, you know, they actually define their opponents a little bit. But I think there is a case to make that Marx actually endorses some of these true socialist ideas before he criticizes them. So it's a way of, and which might explain some of the hostility, is that he's also criticizing his own intellectual journey in a way.
Which is, I think, also an aspect of why I brought this up, is because in the 21st century, anti-politics is relevant. And some of us have been involved in anti-politics and have a critique of our former political positions in a way that is not unsimilar to the vehemence with which someone like Marx might attack true socialism.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true of my own personal trajectory as well. I mean, I was very influenced by the kind of Occupy model, which was when I was, you know, like 20, 21, was coming on, getting involved in politics. And it was only really for me, at least personally, I think like quite a few people in my generation, Corbyn taking, winning the election to the leadership of the Labour Party, that suddenly made me think, oh, well, okay, there might be this other model of organisation that might need looking at. And I think that's true of quite a number of people in my generation.
And I wonder if it wasn't a similar effect in the 19th century, because, you know, I think we're about the same age. The thing is when you get into politics, at least as an American around Occupy, there's no like party that's legitimate. There's like barely any left social institutions at all.
Yeah.
So if you want to do anything, you're going to be autonomous. Like when I was organizing stuff as a young person, there's nobody to help.
Yeah.
You just have to figure it out with your friends. And I feel like if you're going to England and visiting with Owenists, you might have this impression like, well, the French Revolution failed. Robespierre failed. All this stuff failed. Maybe we have to like take a different approach to the question of the state and institutions and all these things. I can see how an Engels might think that, like coming out of the pressure, you know what I mean? Coming out of these contexts.
Yeah, no, I think
it's understandable.
It's a really excellent comparison, I've got to say. I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, but yeah, no, there is something to that. And I think, so this is actually, I think, maybe worth emphasizing is that in a way, when Engels goes and encounters Owenism, one way to think about it is that you can look at republicanism and go, that's actually the ideology of the past, right? They tried it in the revolution and it massively failed. And that is certainly an explanation for the anti-politics of early socialism, right? So when you're looking at the writings of Owen, Fourier, Saint-Simon, you know, this supposed triumvirate of early socialism, it's a bit problematic, and but we can just take it for the moment, is that a lot of them are reacting to the French Revolution, right? This is supposed to be a path towards, you know, social harmony and equality that doesn't go through the violence of the terror, right? And all the kind of associations of the French Revolution, right? And that's you know, why early socialism really like pushes against that republican heritage. I mean, in those critical years, 1820s, 1830s, republicanism and socialism are really quite separate things. So socialism is, in a lot of ways, you know, very much a middle class affair of idealists in a lot of way. And, you know, what republicanism is really, so far as republicanism can show its head at all because of the heavy state repression, is much more associated in a kind of with popular working class politics. You know, I mean, that's certainly the case with Chartism in the UK. You know, Owenism is very clear that he's opposed to the kind of working class Chartist demands. I feel like I've gotten a little bit off track, but I think you made a very nice comparison.
I just think it's important because it's not obvious. Like for me now in my French context, where in my day-to-day politics, these two like traditions or ideologies or however you want to schematize it are fully fused. It all makes sense to me. It's all just like the water I'm swimming in. But if you think about it from the perspective of the people at the time, there's no reason to believe that, you know, republicanism would win. It was losing everywhere in the world.
Yeah.
Oh, like yeah, France sure. was a monarchy. You know what I mean? Like the king came back, folks.
Yeah.
And like the king came back in England too. And the kings are everywhere. You know, I just think we also have to kind of, as we say in French, like doser a little bit the critique of somebody like Engels in this anti-political turn and say like, you know, it kind of makes sense what he was doing. But why not stick with the anti-politics? I guess to move the story forward, why did they stop doing the anti-politics?
Yeah, this is great. This is really interesting. I mean, one reason has to be, so if we're looking at the young Engels, so there's a really lovely set of articles by my old PhD supervisor, David Leopold, who's written a little bit about Engels's kind of early views, particularly around this idea of the transition to socialism. So what's completely forgotten, I mentioned this kind of like essay prize idea. What's also forgotten is that Engels is for a while very enthusiastic about communitarian socialism, right? So this idea that you can have like these small scale experimental communities, you know, that particularly, you know, get set up in America, you know, in the 1820s, 30s and 40s, you know, inspired by Owenism and Fourierism. Not Saint-Simonianism. Saint-Simonianism is not a communitarian position, but you know, this is you know, socialism in practice for a lot of people at that time. Communities that have chosen to live together in this very like
they're like communes is what they are. They're like little communes,
exactly. And Engels is very enthusiastic about these. And writes a very enthusiastic review about them. And I think what you find is, I think in the early 1840s, 1844, 1845, increasing evidence that they're not working, right? They keep failing, they keep closing down, and it's just obvious to more and more people that this is just not likely to succeed. And that is, I think that takes a while to settle in as a lesson. So that anti-political path, and I would define that as an anti-political path to socialism, you know, you'll see these small scale communities will keep spreading by the power of their example. That then loses credibility. It takes a little bit longer. So, I mean, even Cabet in 1848 leads, you know, an exodus of workers, I don't know how many thousand, to try and set up a commune in the US, right? So it still has some attraction to it.
Yeah.
But it generally starts to seem increasingly unlikely. That's one reason. I suppose what could be further reasons? Well, one is that socialism starts to become more associated with the working class. And that might mean that the kind of some of the things that appeal to the working class, so the kind of, let's say, Chartist kind of demands, some of the kind of Republican influences in like working class strongholds like Lyon and so forth, that might be, so the influence of republicanism merging with socialism. These are somewhat, I feel like I'm sounding a bit speculative, and that's because it is slightly speculative. I wouldn't, well, someone would have, you'd have to really ask a social historian. This is not, this is, I really do intellectual history, and I think you really need to do social history to tell this story properly.
You
But
don't.
those would be some of the
But for
facts.
Marx and Engels specifically, this is a period that doesn't go on for decades and decades. It's a relatively short period. And for whatever reason, they come out of it and they take a new direction. So maybe talk
Oh,
about
yeah. So
the
for
new
Marx,
direction.
well, and yeah, so one of the things I kind of briefly discuss in the book is what, insofar as Marx may have had an anti-political moment, and I think I do want to stress that it is a little bit uncertain and short and textually thin compared to Engels. It seems that what might have been quite important is that in 1845 they go and spend some time in Manchester and London. And there they're coming, but the two of them, they have kind of this, it's something that's called a study trip. And there they're coming into contact with a lot of left Chartists. And it might be that that might be one of the things that leads them to a more explicit commitment to politics and republicanism. And it's very soon after that that Engels writes what I think is a very definitive statement where he says, "We are democratic communists." He uses that term, if I remember rightly. Well, he certainly does it in an article a few months later. I can't remember if that, but he makes very clear in that article, this is like September 1845 or so, that socialism needs to embrace its revolutionary French revolutionary heritage, which is not obvious, right? So he's really responding to socialists who say the French Revolution has nothing to teach us. Someone like Karl Grün has just published an article, and this is again where this contextualism, I hope, comes in, the importance of understanding Engels's text as a response to a different way of seeing things. And that is, I think, quite a key set of moments, that period in the summer of 1845, it would seem.
So they're coming out of this, and your book, as we've mentioned, takes these kind of, it follows Marx's life as he's going through all of these sort of experiences and studies and developing. And you mentioned his sort of turn towards political economy. So now we're really approaching this like mature reflection, I think, that you develop in the third part of the book, which you spend not an insignificant amount of time talking about how Marx responds to the commune. So maybe you can take us from the study trip to Manchester up through the commune.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, you say, like, yeah, the book kind of follows Marx's life. I mean, the book does have elements of being a bit of a biography. That wasn't my intention when I started on it, but because it kind of like it dealt with kind of discrete moments to some extent. And then increasingly, as I wrote more and more, they kind of got filled in so that now it is almost a biography in some ways. And then more
I
of it.
think honestly, people should buy this and the New Capital and like read this first. Honestly, like read this, get a sense of the context, get a sense of how Marx is evolving, and then jump into your Capital reading group. I think it would be a very easy kind of reading group progression that would help a lot of people. Because if you just
Well,
start Capital with no context, it's not, I mean, I make like in religious stuff, we joke about like the when you, people try to read the Bible. They try to read it from Genesis all the way through, and they burn out in like Numbers and Leviticus, and like the Law of Moses is hard to read, folks.
yeah. Well, I mean, of course, I can only encourage, of course, people to buy it at the same time as the Capital translation. I would love that in terms of my personal sales. And I hope that it could provide, I mean, yeah, I would hope that the book provide, if you have never read anything about Marx, I would hope that this gives you a pretty nice introduction to quite a lot of Marx's thought. Not everything, but quite a lot. Although I have to say that, I have so much respect for Will Roberts's book, Marx's Inferno, which really does a very nice job of contextualizing Capital. So I would also very much plug that as a book that could be read in preparation for Capital. So you asked me to give
Just to bring us through the sort of timeline up to the commune, because you spend like I think that's a really interesting part of your book where you talk about the influence of the commune in Marx's thought.
So the influence of the commune, I guess the way that I see it is that, I kind of maybe hinted at this at a couple of points in the in our discussion so far, that, when Marx becomes a Republican communist in 44, 45, leading up to 48, you know, that is already an important incorporation of republicanism in the sense of endorsing universal suffrage, equal civic rights, that we have to engage ourselves in politics, these kind of things, right? But I do think there's a little bit something that get kind of falls a little bit by the wayside in this transition. So that's some of his kind of more radical early republican ideas. So, you know, in his critique of Hegel, he gives us a kind of very encompassing sense of what political life should look like, that we, you know, are involved in public administration, we control our representatives, and, you know, it's much more a deeper sense of democracy, let's say. And that, I think, falls a little bit by the wayside. And that's why I think the commune is so important, because I think it comes back at that moment, right? It is, you know, like he suddenly then, you know, he says, and you know, Marx doesn't correct himself very well. He corrects himself all the time, but he doesn't always say that he's corrected himself. And this is one of the moments when, you know, he writes a new, him and Engels write a new preface to the Communist Manifesto, and they're like, one thing we should have stressed more or didn't actually get right at all in the original was that we just said you can take power in the bourgeois republic, you know, just as it sounds, and then, you know, carry out socialism from there. But actually, what you need is a much more deeper transformation of the state if you're supposed to get socialism from it. And that is something that he really gains from the Paris Commune, this, you know, the kind of radical democratic experiment. And I guess maybe why I think the intellectual trajectory is important, because Marx gives the impression in his writings on the Commune as if it's just come out of nowhere. This just is the Paris Commune, and that's like taught us this lesson. But, you know, a lot of what he's saying there actually is already what he'd written as a very young man, and actually is already there in European republicanism for the 100 years or so before it. These are ideas that he endorses for the Paris Commune that had already been discussed amongst radicals in the French Revolution. There's a, you know, republican heritage to it. So it doesn't just come out of nowhere in that way. And that's why I think telling the trajectory is quite important. Obviously, you know, having that experiment right there and actually happening right on the doorstep in Paris, which he's, you know, watching from London, matters to really making it obvious to him. But the elements are already there in his own thought and in republicanism more widely.
I think it's really important what you're saying, because this insight that he's developing and that you're tracing, as we mentioned earlier, is not at all obvious to everybody in the sort of socialist to communist movement. Even after, long after the commune, into the 20th century, people are arguing, do we even need a German Republic? Or can we just do get what we need to get in the German Empire?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, what is of course interesting is that it is obvious to someone like Lenin, right? If you read State and Revolution, he's very clear that that you know how important Marx's writings on the Paris Commune are, and that he sets out a different political structure there than what we might be familiar with as democracy. The tragedy, of course, with Lenin, from my perspective at least, is that you know he didn't manage that he didn't implement that. That different political structure, right? I mean, and you know, he has hopes for it, and he, you know, sometimes talks about it, but it kind of, you know, as the revolution progresses, increasingly falls away, and you get a much more, you know, some of the criticisms of the kind of formation of technocracy and bureaucracy that Marx had really wanted to avoid with this kind of vision of popular public administration.
You quote Marx in chapter 7 saying that, quote, a republic is only in France and Europe possible as a social republic, that is, a republic which disowns the capital and landowner class of the state machinery to supersede it by the commune, that frankly avows social emancipation as the great goal of the republic and guarantees thus that social transformation by the communal organization. So for me, to have this, what he's talking about, you have to have the communal organization, which means you have to have some French revolutionary-esque social restructuring. You can't go straight from like a kingdom and feudalism to the social republic.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, well, yeah, I, yeah, let
Because the
me.
social republic itself is not even like the communist, like communism isn't realized in the sense of being a state of affairs. It's a process working out through this establishment of the social republic, if I understand that quote correctly.
Yeah, I mean, I think he says that, yeah, this, he says that, you know, the commune itself was not socialism yet, right? And couldn't be. And the social republic is not socialism yet either. It's just supposed to be the better political terrain in which to work towards socialism, right? I mean, he certainly thinks that the bourgeois republic is already an improvement over absolute monarchy or constitutional monarchy, as the terrain, but this is supposed to be an even more conducive one because he thinks he's committed to the idea that a more radically democratic constitution will be one that allows social transformation to come out of it.
And I guess this gets to bring all this back to the present day and why is this relevant? I mean, a lot of people are interested in changing our form of social organization, given ecocide, the Anthropocene, war, genocide, everything all over the world. And there's a question of like, how do we act? Can we just like nationalize everything? And some of the discussions that I'm in France is the idea that could we take elements of the like, you know, bourgeois social democratic state, like the welfare state, and could we put like trade unions in charge of that? Could we change the relationship of workers and capital, change this terrain by giving trade unions actually more direct political power? Is that a way? And like, I'm not saying that, yeah, that's exactly what we're going to do, but this whole establishment of the social republic is like what our political project today in France is attempting to take the Fifth Republic and to abolish it and to establish a Sixth Republic, which would be social, right? So like for us, that's one of the reasons why I said, you know, to you earlier, I think this book is like an excellent introduction to the contemporary French radical left, you know, because it's basically what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's a really nice way of putting it in the sense that, you know, I don't think that the specific institutional setup that Marx suggests is the one we have to adopt, right? Today, right? If we're trying to think about new political structures, you know, you mentioned the idea of this, you know, giving trade unions greater political power and control, right? I think that it's more important to me is the insight from what he's working on is that this set of structures don't work and we need a much more radically democratic one, right? And that can be fleshed out in all kinds of ways, right? And different sets of institutions. Yeah. And they also change over time, what might be the most interesting and effective. And certainly I find that something that I find quite interesting, you know, you mentioned the Sixth Republic, and that's something that I've always found quite interesting about Mélenchon and, France Unbowed, that this commitment to, well, actually the political architecture that we have in France is not conducive to the kind of emancipation we want. And that I think is definitely an instantiation of a kind of Republican insight, right? That doesn't treat politics as just something separate and secondary in that way. And that I'm very, I find that very animating. And you did find elements of it also in the Corbyn project a little bit. A little bit in Sanders as well, but I think maybe not quite as at the
for
forefront.
Sanders to stuff to work, they would have had to say we need a new American Constitution because the American Constitution is so like reactionary in its nature. I mean, it was even like if Tom Paine is your left wing,
yes,
you know, you're like barely into liberal republicanism. And I think that's something that people don't think enough about. Like we talk about the Electoral College in America and how it's bad and all this stuff, but
yeah, well, I mean,
the legal structure of America makes, like, if I wanted to start a new party with you, it's going to be a hell of a ride to try to even get on the ballot in all 50 states.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, when American conservatives say that, you know, the Constitution says that America is a republic and not a democracy, they're not wrong, right?
They're right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that, where they're wrong is, of course, it should be a democracy, right?
Yeah, it should be a democracy.
And I would say, you know, if we're telling the wider story of republicanism, I think, you know, the American Constitution is an example of the elitist elements of republicanism winning over the more popular democratic right? If you think about the victory of mostly victory of the Federalists over the anti-Federalists, right? And so I guess,
if the commune, as it says, you know, if the commune can't just lay hold to the state machinery, it's not simply enough to capture the state machinery.
Yes.
And
exactly.
It's not simply enough to start a commune somewhere and to just hope that the state collapses or that you spread or that you somehow like undermine the normal society through a kind of this alternative, right? Then you have to take head on politics in the narrow sense of like, we have to have a different established order.
Yeah. And I mean, I think you mentioned the need to transform the American Constitution. I think there's finally a little bit more discussion of this. I'm forgetting there's a very good new book written by a legal scholar about this, about America's obsession with forgetting his name, but this obsession with the Constitution and a need to really radically rethink it. And I'm glad that that kind of discussion is happening because, you know, the American Constitution doesn't even meet basic bourgeois republican standards in some ways, or modern, as you say, right? I mean, you know, it is a lot easier to organize for socialism and has been in a European political system than it has been in America. And I think I would actually, you know, one reason I would argue for why there has not been, you know, this, you know, the grand question of why is there no socialist party in the US, right? One reason at least is that the political system itself, right? There are all kinds of other factors, of course, you know, in America, but that one reason is that the political system itself protects itself against that, right? Somewhat deliberately, somewhat by chance. And even having, let's say, you know, I would want a much more democratic system than exists in Europe. But if you at least had a European style democracy in America, you would already have greater space for sure. That wouldn't be nearly sufficient for me, but that would already be a step in the right direction for sure.
Just think about the French system. How much advantage does the left get out of people being able to vote their conscience in the first round and then vote, you know, strategically, quote unquote, in the second round? Now, usually the critique is made in the opposite way, that the strategic voting is a hindrance, and I understand that it is. But there's also, from like the American perspective, the fact that you can at least have people publicly say, I would prefer the further left thing, is important for people to know that it's real, that it is possible, and that you can get from that first round to second round. You know what I mean? I think there's something about that in Europe that allows institutions to have, you know, like left institutions, I mean, to grow and to
I think this
continue.
Is a fantastic example because, you know, France is still a majoritarian electoral system like America and Britain, but it just by the mere fact that it has this two-stage thing, right, compared to America, allows smaller parties to have a chance, right? And the fact that you do, in fact, have smaller parties represented in parliament as a result of it, right? And it's just a really nice example for me for how, like, you know, a small institutional architectural change can have very big effects as to what kind of politics are possible, so that you don't get to anywhere near the same extent this endless discussion in France that you have in America, this endless discussion of like, should you be voting for the Green Party? Should you be voting for Jill Stein? You're undermining the Democrats or something like this, right? Which all has a certain logic within the American system, right? But just isn't important when it comes to a proportional system or a semi-majoritarian system like France, right? And that's, for me, I guess, I think a quite nice instantiation of, well, the importance of the design of political institutions.
And it also opens a path where, like, one of the things we're pushing for in France is more proportional voting stuff, right? And the reason, why do we want to do that? We want to do that because we need to shift the sort of balance of power such that more, you know, radical left, basically, the radical left can grow in strength and push forward. And this kind of, like, smaller wins that cumulatively grow into a bigger win feels more possible in our context, whereas in the US it's just like a wipeout. Like the victory of Trump, a lot of people are talking about this as a total wipeout, a total defeat. Some people are even saying this is going to be the end of American democracy, blah blah blah, because the system is so totalizing and like swinging. You know, if Trump would have been defeated, people would be writing articles today that, you know, Trumpism and populism is dead, it's over. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, really, it's neither of these things. You know what I mean? Really, it was a matter of, I don't know, 10%, 12% of the Democratic voters decided not to show up on a particular day.
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course, that seems to be the story of the election, right? That it's not Trump convincing a whole bunch of people. It's young Democrats not turning up because they're just completely unenthused by the party.
Yeah. And so when you have a system that is so swingy, you end up with a politics that is like this whiplash effect that is devastating for folks to actually organize in. And I think there's something about this, take it back to your text, talking about like the Chartists all the way up to like William Morris and all this sort of like global building. I wonder, in your view, why did all of this get like so forgotten?
Oof. Wow. Okay. This is a really important question. I guess, well, one reason is that I think is republicanism itself gets forgotten about, right? So it's very within
the good old cause.
Well, within academia, there has now for quite a long time been, you know, what is called a Republican revival. So there's been an attempt to unearth this historical loss. It's had some impact outside of academia, but quite limited in some ways. And I think it is true that, for certainly much of the 20th century, and even now, if we were to define the big ideologies, it's still to some extent liberalism, conservatism, and socialism, right? And republicanism is just not in that picture at all.
Yeah.
And I think we read those things backwards, as it were, into the 19th century, and that means republicanism falls by the wayside. So I think
Or
that...
it's just confused with liberalism.
Exactly. Yeah, this is, yeah, definitely. It gets confused with liberalism, and it gets the fact that there were people who just, people are elected to the Frankfurt Parliament 1848 who are not liberals. They think of themselves as Democrats, as Republicans, right? And it's a really helpful moment because, once people have to actually set themselves up as factions, right, which is the first stage towards the formation of political parties in the modern sense of political parties, you start to see those differences very clearly, much more clearly. It's always a bit more diffuse in an authoritarian situation when people can't as organize as clearly in that way. So why else does it get lost? Well, of course, I mean, another major reason is, of course, the victory of a certain kind of authoritarian socialism in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I would say it's all 1917. I think 1917 is so definitional for the left in the 20th century and 21st century that everything before it is like a preface.
Yeah.
And really, like, by the time you get to the, I guess, through World War II, like when the Third International breaks down, like all of socialist development in like ideology happened in that period.
We've talked a little bit about Lenin and so forth and the tragedy of it all. And, I don't want to come across it. I have a lot of, respect for a lot of aspects of Lenin's thought, but also some skepticism as well. And I also think that, a footnote I would add to my earlier comments is that, I obviously don't think that Lenin is Stalin. I think there are major and serious differences. And had, as is often said, had Lenin stayed, lived longer, we might have seen a quite different path. But I think that's the really crucial Republican thing, if I can say, is that it should never have depended on one person. Right. That's the Republican emphasis on structures and institutions, because if you'd set up the institutions correctly, it wouldn't matter who is the particular head of state, the particular figurehead. Right. That Lenin could have died and then the next democratically mandated, socialist leader could have taken over. Right. But because
the opposite is also true. Right. Like, this is my sort of critique of the whole Russian situation, is that if somebody just like kills him, or if he dies for whatever reason, there's no reason to believe that Russian hostilities in all around the world would stop.
Yeah.
The system has its kind of inertia, and once you set it up, it's running. That's politics in the narrow sense, which I feel. Do you think that the post 68 generation obscured politics in this narrower sense?
Oof.
When we think about like the revolution of everyday life and this sense of politics, I kind of, in my mind, I have a scheme of like, there's the larger sense and the narrower sense. So like the larger sense is like everything is political in the larger sense, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
like my ability to cut you off and impose myself is political. Like I'm dominating you in this conversation, right? But in the narrow sense of politics, the way that we talk on this Zoom call is not political.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's hard. Of course, there's a certain contradiction here. So I fully believe that the personal is political, right? So I'm committed. Yeah. That is a socialist, that is a feminist belief, right? It's very important.
Yeah.
That's what Marx says on the Jewish question, in the way, right? That, you can't just have political emancipation. We need emancipation in the social sphere, and it has to go beyond. That is, but also at the same time, the political is also political, I suppose. In the sense that we sometimes forget that we need to actually, the thing that is most, this constitutions and politics do need their own study, separate from, other social spheres that are also, I guess the problem is that we just mean political in lots of different senses, right? Mm-hmm. And then, when I say something is anti-political or non-political, it shouldn't be taken as, let's say, that's in itself a criticism.
It's just a descriptive. Yeah. We might criticize that things have like what I'm kind of thinking about, and I'm not saying this is a dogma that you must accept. I have the impression that at least in English language discourse, the narrower sense of the political has been obscured.
Yeah, I think
that's not as talked about enough as it should be vis-a-vis the larger sense. But that could be wrong.
Yeah, and of course, that is a theme of a certain kind of Republican writing in the 20th century. In a way, that's kind of a Hannah Arendt kind of position. It's a Sheldon Wolin kind of position. I think that they make a mistake by saying that Marx is the one to blame for this in some ways, right? So they fit him into that category of a kind of anti-political, which I think gets it completely wrong. But they're not wrong to identify a certain disregard of politics that happens. Not just on the left, but I think across, because I think what happens in the 20th century is that there is a fair degree of consensus on the political architecture that we all work in, right? It's a consensus around around liberal democracy to some extent. Obviously, there are people who contest it, right? But on the whole, social democrats, liberals, conservatives say, okay, within this architecture, we agreed that's the politics settled. That is what the architecture looks like. And we fight over our different social visions within that architecture.
Yes. And when you think about, I mean, towards the end of your book, you quote, I think it's the Critique of the Gotha Program, where Marx talks about how the social transformation of the existing institutions to the future institutions has to be, what do you say? It has to be described or responded to scientifically. Let me see if I can find the quote. It says the question, okay, the question arises, what transformation will the body politic undergo in communist society? What social functions remain in existence that are analogous to present state functions? This question can only be answered scientifically. So how do you propose to scientifically answer that, Bruno?
Well, I'm going to make the somewhat cheap move, which is to say that I think that it's important that Marx means their Wissenschaft, science, Wissenschaft in the German sense, in that kind of somewhat more encompassing, that it doesn't just mean, like we were going to scientifically study that in the way of like natural science. I think he means it in the sense of that we need rigorous, disciplined thinking about it. I think that's what he means by science there. And then how do we do that? Well,
Because you put a nice ellipsis right before the meat of, hey, we're going to do it scientifically. Let's go.
I mean, I would say that I don't think my book has that much to say about organizing and strategy. And I think, and that partly reflects some of my own weaknesses. I find it difficult thinking about these things and writing about them. I have more to say about what institutions should look like.
Well,
And
to
I
be fair, you do note that Marx immediately changed the topic after the ellipsis, so.
That is true. That I mean, so Marx doesn't help us in that moment, right? Yeah, that's true. So that yeah, so I yeah, I can use that as my excuse. And I
But if you
think
want to change the topic to the institutions that you're interested in, I mean, I think you and I would agree also with the Unbowed and some of the other contemporary radical left movements that we need a constitutional, I guess, a narrow political change. We need more sortition. We need recallable delegates. We need shorter terms, you know?
yeah, I think these are all part of what we might think of as of a constitutional toolbox. Things, ideas that we could draw on when we want to think about in our various different contexts, what might be a way in which we could democratize the state and make it more amenable to the kind of social emancipation that we want.
I mean, isn't your hero Keir Starmer abolishing the house of the hereditary peership or something?
I cannot tell you how much I do not think of Starmer as my hero.
Sir Keir as your favorite guy?
Sir
No, but
Keir.
isn't in England, aren't you get rid of the peerage, at least among the English peers or something? The hereditary aspect?
There is hope that the House of Lords might be finally reformed a little bit. I don't hold out much hope. I think that yes, they'll maybe remove the final remaining hereditary peers, which of course should happen. There's no doubt about that. And maybe they'll make it elected in some form. I
Like a
think,
Senate, basically.
yeah, I haven't seen that many detailed proposals of what they're thinking. There is an interesting, there is a campaign to turn it into a house chosen by sortition, so random selection. I don't think that campaign will not be successful, I don't
But
think,
you
but
and I are both partisans of a unicameral legislature, I'm sure.
of course. Well, I think I'm a partisan of a unicameral legislature if it's elect if it's own yeah if we're only talking about elections. If the second house is chosen by sortition, I'm a little bit more interested in the idea of a bicameral solution. I certainly think a single elected chamber is better than two elected chambers with a
And how
with
do you
a
prevent this kind of reflection? Because, like, interesting to think about England today, right? If we phrase, like, okay, England today, how do we take England or the UK or whatever body we're talking about and make it like a social republic? I think that's an interesting project. But how do you prevent that from becoming like a sort of form of utopianism? Because if we
Well,
start about unicameralism, bicameralism, it can seem like abstract, right?
sure. I mean,
Would you say, like, the UK system, it's possible to reform it to be something that you would want? Or would there need to be some kind of rupture with a new constitution? Or is that sedition, if I ask you that question?
well, let's hope it's not sedition. I think that the no, I mean, I think if we actually wanted socialism, you would need a fundamental rupture. You would, but that is
You need 1789, basically.
or something close to it, right? That I think is
You need
correct.
somebody to proclaim that, as I have right here, something was delivered through a sort of divine revelation,
The do you want to read that out loud, perhaps? Was it that's the
I was
declaration?
holding up my copy of the Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen, which is basically you don't have in the UK.
No, I mean, of course, there's the failed revolution of the 17th century, right? So, in some ways, England tried, a century before France and failed, right? But, they also, we, if I can use that term, also cut off a king's head. So, France copied England in that sense. I guess, yes. I mean, I think that, but I also believe in there's something like constitutional moments, right? In order for a really grand new constitutional moment or compromise to exist, that has to exist for certain, has to. I don't think that that can be forced about. That comes about, as it were. That'll be true in the U.S. I mean, the U.S. needs a new constitution for sure.
I always struggle in English how to translate the idea of rapport de force.
How?
I don't have a good translation in my mind, but you have to have a kind of, because balance of power is too static. For me, rapport de force is like something that you can push, And basically they got in France to the point where they could say to the king, you need to give us these rights. You need to recognize these. And he did,
I just, I want to make a quick note. He's executed as citizen Louis Capet, right?
Yeah, of course.
And I think that that's just, for readers who might have wondered why I call it Citizen Marx, it is because if there is this republican tradition of using citizen as this replacement for the aristocratic titles that emerges in France at
Oh,
that
yeah.
time. And it's still the case in Marx's lifetime. So he's referred to as Citizen Marx all the time with the International Working Men's Association. Such a reminder of, like, why did I
No, but
choose
it's
this
important to
title?
address. I mean, this is a common aspect, is to address people as citizens, to address people in this egalitarian fraternal way, And I think, like, even in the 20th century, we see, figures like Puyi, that the head coming off isn't actually what's necessary. Puyi was willing to just become a citizen. And because there was a kind of social power to, like, defeat the old regime, to establish itself, and to say, like, it was in the French Revolution, it was obvious to everyone that something had to give,
No, I
And
mean,
I just wonder, I wonder how to get to that in the contemporary context with which is so.
I mean that I and I don't think that we can really, I don't think that, revolutions can't be predicted really, or I mean very rarely so. And I mean, of course, we also know that revolutions aren't always to be welcomed either, of course, because they can go very seriously wrong, right? They're just, I think revolution, I would, and of course, we would need a very fundamental reworking of the British state if we wanted something like socialism. But that doesn't mean, of course, that we can't make, important reforms now that might make it easier to do something like that, in the
We would
future.
have to. If we take this perspective that Marx and stuff in the later chapters you're talking about, you have to do it. There's not really a way around it.
No, for sure. And of course, in a very, very prosaic way, the House of Lords reform, I suppose, is part of that, although it's hard to get very excited by it. Although, I guess if I was to take my own lessons seriously, I should take, the reform of that political institution seriously. I guess it's just because the political horizon of what reform looks like right now is just quite uninspiring. of what the type
No, of course. And I'm asking these questions a little bit tongue in cheek, in part because I've never been to the UK. I know nothing about it, you know, except for like John Ball and Winstanley and stuff like this. But
I think that one important thing that happens after Marx is the rise of political parties. And, you know, Marx sees the beginnings of it in 1880, 81, 80, so just before he dies, really. But like the modern sense of a social democratic party, you know, that's and that the rise of that really changes the socialist view about politics in a lot of ways. And I think political parties are completely necessary. I don't, you know, I'm not trying to make an anti-political party argument, but I think that is one reason for the why a little bit of this Republican insistence on more democratic political structures gets forgotten, because the thought is that actually it's the political party that democratizes the state in a way, because it is the missing link between citizens and the state, right? It is the channel in which democratic demands flow, right? And that it has a lot of truth to it, right? It is actually an important democratizing force. And it's one reason why our systems of government have become less democratic is that we no longer have that intermediary function in a way that parties once made. This is the kind of Peter Mayer argument, you know, ruling the void, that without political parties, there is just this void between citizens and state. But it is, yeah, and that is because the state itself, as it is structured in this kind of bourgeois republic, liberal democracy, whatever we call it, creates this void between citizens and states. And, you know, I suppose republicanism wanted to avoid and overcome that void through its much more democratic structures. I don't
no,
know if we got to the kind of
no. That's good. I would ask one other question that I should have asked before, but I'll go ahead and ask now, because you do talk about the First International, but I don't remember in the book if you talk about this. I simply didn't note it and I've forgotten it, so I'm sorry. But you don't really talk about anarchism.
Oh yes, you're right, and I think that.
So how does this relate to the split in the First International?
Yeah, I mean, if I had
between
made
communists and anarchists.
I mean, if I had wanted to make the book even longer, anarchism would have been one of the things that I discuss more fully. You know, there's some discussion of anarchism when I'm talking about anti-political socialism, although I would make a distinction there, because of course I see the anti-political socialism I'm talking about is a little bit more the kind of early 1840s, and anarchism is something that, you know, develops a little bit later and has distinctions, but also influences from that earlier period.
Yeah.
And I would say in some ways, yes, anarchism is a reaction against the Republican inheritance of socialism. Certainly, it's, you know, if it's a rejection of the importance of a democratic republic and a willingness to like participate in it, whether through elections and so forth, that is certainly a rejection of the Republican inheritance. But I'm sure someone who would write a more encompassing history of anarchism would also say that there are also various Republican continuities within it. And how does that relate to the split? Well, I don't really deal with that in the book. And I think that's one thing maybe I would like to emphasize is that I think that, you know, I do believe that republicanism speaks to so many aspects of Marxist thought, but there are also parts that for which it's less relevant and less central to the story. And so I think that, you know, this isn't a complete biography of Marx's political life. And anything. And I think that there are some, you know, if one was to write a more complete book, of course, then the Hague Conference of 72 and so forth, where there is that anarchist split and so forth, would need to also be part of the story.
Oh, but that's good that you also trace here at the end the limits of your book, because it's the limits of the relevance of the topic. And I think, you know, you went on at some detail. I appreciate your time allotted for this interview. And I will also mention that your book is forthcoming. It should be available next week at time of recording, so end of November in the US. And then you said in January for Europe?
Yes.
And the UK?
Exactly. Well, yeah, so there's the US publication date and then there's the worldwide publication date. But I think some people might be able to get outside of the US might be able to get hold of it already. There are some behemoth book publishers, I won't mention by name.
We will not name by name.
Who
that you can pre-order.
Yes, as a good socialist, of course, I never use that particular behemoth. But I think if one were to order from it, I think that one receives it a little bit earlier. So if you're very keen, I think you can get hold of it that way.
And people can also go to the Princeton University Press website?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly where I would recommend ordering it from most. But that, if you're in the US, you'll get hold of it now or like within the next week or two. But it'll take longer to be available if you order it from them if you're outside of the US.
Was there anything I didn't ask you about that you wanted to talk about before we end here?
I mean, it was so elaborate what you asked. I mean, I've been very animated and challenged by the questions. I think that, I mean, it covers everything from, I don't want to open up new avenues where I might embarrass myself. So I've been
No, I mean,
very
I embarrass myself all the time. It's normal. We're just here
excited.
talking. And like, for people should know that none of this stuff is scripted that we're doing here. We're just talking about the book. And for me, I think it's really a very valuable contribution. I appreciate that you made it very much. I hope that it's people know that this is not just a work of like abstract theory, but it's an act of solidarity and of attempting to move forward the cause of, the society of the future. And yeah, I would just really thank you, Bruno. Thank you for coming on the show. And hopefully we get a chance to talk again sometime. Maybe you can come south for your health.
Yeah, I would definitely. I always love escaping the English autumn and winter. I don't need much excuse to do that.